kind of 10-minute break. Now, in today's lecture, now you may have noticed that the ER module has a lot of nutrition. If you have not noticed it, please notice it now, because these are the topics that we want you all to read if you want to get the points. If you don't read, you don't get the points. I know nutrition is kind of easy because you eat like at least 3 times a day. Yeah. So, but if you do not read it, I'm afraid that you cannot get the points. Yeah. So we don't want you to lose points on the questions that are kind of easier. Okay. So make sure you do the DLA for all the nutrition topics, as well as, of course, the you will have to read endocrine and reproduction. Yeah. So. A part of this module is also nutrition, so I just want to alert you on that and make sure you get every single point on the nutrition questions, okay? So with that warning to you all, I just want to begin with nutritional aspects of diabetes mellitus, yeah? And in this lecture, we are going to look at what is the main risk factor for development of type 2 diabetes mellitus, because it's a nutritional risk factor, and that is obesity. What is the mechanism of insulin resistance? We shall look at briefly what is the mechanism of the whole process or the whole term called insulin resistance. And finally, towards the end of the lecture, we are going to look at the nutritional management of diabetes mellitus, because that's an integral and important component in the management of patients with diabetes mellitus. Yeah, so we're going to look at all of these in a little more detail in today's lecture. Now, if you think about the global disease burden of diabetes mellitus, it's said that one in every 20 people now has diabetes mellitus. Most of your patients, about 90% of your patients, are going to be type 2 diabetes mellitus. About 10% of the diabetic population is type 1 diabetes mellitus. Now, it's found that with the increasing incidence of obesity, diabetes mellitus has become a public health problem, and the WHO has coined the word diabesity, which is due to the main risk factor for type 2 diabetes mellitus, and that is obesity. Whatever field you choose, remember, diabetes mellitus can affect multiple organ systems. So make sure you learn about diabetes mellitus before you enter the clinic. Yeah? Now, type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus, we're going to look at it in a little more detail. Now, in the nutritional aspects of pregnancy and lactation, you saw the term gestational diabetes, which is basically diabetes that happens during pregnancy, that is hyperglycemia during pregnancy. Once the female delivers, the blood glucose comes back to normal. However, these females have a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes mellitus as they grow older. Okay, so that is about gestational diabetes, and you've seen the complications that can happen when there is diabetes during pregnancy. Now, since you're in the endocrine module, you will understand the term secondary diabetes, where there is other disorders, other endocrine disorders that can result in hyperglycemia, like increased secretion of cortisol. Cushing syndrome patients have hyperglycemia. Increased secretion of epinephrine or pheochromocytoma patients could have hyperglycemia. Growth hormone over-secretion could result in hyperglycemia. And patients with tumor of the alpha cells of the pancreas, known as glucagon secretin tumor or glucagonoma, can have high blood glucose levels. These three hormones are called as the counter-regulatory hormones. They are responsible to increase your blood glucose level, and when you have very high circulating levels of these counter-regulatory hormones, there can be hyperglycemia. And they will contribute to the phenomenon of insulin resistance. Now, besides that, imagine the beta cells of the pancreas are destroyed by a compound like iron. So iron overload disorder can result in destruction of the beta cells of the pancreas, and that disorder you're going to study in the next module. So keep that at the back of your mind when you think about patients. But of course, this group of patients is a very small proportion of your total patients with hyperglycemia. That is your the most diseased load is type 2. About 90% of the population of the diabetic population is type 2. Now, briefly about type 1 diabetes mellitus. Now, type 1 diabetes mellitus has some risk factors. So it's considered as a multifactorial disorder. Most likely, there is in people with a genetic predisposition, there is initially a viral infection or some toxin which results in the stimulation of an autoantibody response. What happens there is antibodies develop against the beta cells of the pancreas. And as a result, they slowly start destroying the beta cells of the pancreas in a time period of months to years. Almost all of the beta cells are finally destroyed to result in hyperglycemia or clinically evident type 1 diabetes mellitus. Most of the time, so that is the basic mechanism, is an autoimmune destruction of the beta cells of the pancreas. Now, type 1 diabetes mellitus is also known as insulin dependent previously, and that's because these patients have to be on lifelong insulin treatment to prevent the complications of diabetes mellitus. Typically occurs in adolescents or young adults. Now, if you think about the presenting features of diabetes mellitus, note that the three most traditionally described as the three polys, polydipsia, polyphagia, and polyuria. We shall be explaining the cause for polyuria and polydipsia. Now, these three, the triad or the three polys, are more commonly seen in type 1 diabetics. In other words, type 1 diabetics have a kind of a sudden onset. Whereas type 2, it tends to be more insidious. More of your type 2 patients are kind of like hidden in the population. Besides that, patients could have dehydration depending on the severity of the polyuria. Decreased immunity is a feature present in both, and therefore diabetics tend to have a higher risk of infections. So repeated infection could be one of the presenting features. Now, remember, these are common to both, but the three polys and the dehydration is much more severe and more frequent presentation in type 1 diabetics. So type 1 diabetics typically have a sudden onset presentation. Now, patients with type 1 and 2 can have weight loss, but more pronounced in type 1 diabetes. It may be due to two important factors. One is insulin, remember, is an anabolic hormone. It helps to build up your lipid. So when there is no insulin or absence of insulin, there is going to be breakdown of adipose tag or triacylglycerol. Insulin is also required to build up your muscle protein when there is no insulin. Remember, type 1 diabetics, there is almost undetectable levels of insulin at the time of diagnosis. So what happens then is a process called as negative nitrogen balance. That means the tissue protein is broken down and there is muscle proteolysis. Both of these together result in weight loss. Again, weight loss more frequently observed in type 1 when you compare to type 2. Most of your type 2 patients may be obese. Okay. So we've talked about why is there loss of adipose tissue or muscle. Now, hyperglycemia is a common feature of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus and is required for the diagnosis of diabetes mellitus. If you want to call your patient diabetic, hyperglycemia is an important lab finding, and you have to find hyperglycemia not on one occasion but on more than one occasion. Remember, it affects, so we talked about lipid, it affects carbohydrate and protein metabolism. Yeah? More about the metabolic complications and the metabolic effects of diabetes mellitus we are going to see in the next module. Okay? Now, why is there polyuria and glycosuria? You've learned in the renal module, the CPR module last term, that glucose is completely reabsorbed in the renal tubule and there is almost no glucose in the urine in a normal person. And if you do a dipstick test for glucose, you will find no glucose in the urine. However, in a patient with diabetes mellitus, what happens is the blood glucose level is very high and therefore the filtered load of glucose is high. Glucose is an osmotically active substance. Glucose binds to water and this will be lost in the urine. So you find glucose in the urine, known as glycosuria or glucosuria. Now, since glucose is osmotically active, it increases the loss of water, and that is responsible for the polyuria. Remember that glycosuria is seen and polyuria is seen in both type 1 and type 2 diabetics. It's a common feature for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. So basically, the amount of glucose in the renal tubule exceeds what's called as the reabsorptive capacity of the renal tubule. In other words, when the blood glucose level is more than the renal threshold, I hope you remember what's the renal threshold. Yeah. So whenever the blood glucose level is more than the renal threshold, then the glucose will start appearing in the urine. Can be detected in the urine by a simple dipstick test. Okay. Now, if you want to recapitulate what is the absorptive, reabsorptive mechanism or the reabsorptive transport system, it is SGLT2. Yeah, SGLT1 is in the intestinal GIT, whereas SGLT2 is a typical secondary active transporter present in the renal tubules. Now, since there is more amounts of glucose in the urine in a diabetic patient, many of them are predisposed. They have this complication of repeated urinary tract infections. That's one of the complications that you have to look out for in a patient with diabetes, be it type 1 or type 2, especially the more, if they do not manage, if they're not able to manage, or if they're not compliant, or if the treatment is not adequate. There is a new drug that can be used to manage the or to maintain euglycemia, that is, maintain blood glucose in diabetics. You can increase the renal excretion of glucose. Yeah. So what you basically do is use an inhibitor for SGL to increase the loss of glucose in the urine. One of the complications of that is of patients on SGLT2 inhibitors is they may have repeated urinary tract infections, and that's because of the high glucose in the urine. Okay, so that is one mode of one of the newer modes of therapy. We'll move on to the more disease load, that is type 2 diabetes mellitus. An important risk factor is what's called as abdominal obesity or central obesity, and this is hyperglycemia is one of the component features of what's called a syndrome X or metabolic syndrome. A sedentary lifestyle, so I think the whole world is moving towards a sedentary lifestyle. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, after my diabetes lecture, for the next 2 weeks, I'm like walking all over. That's because, you know, it's like I've heard myself, so I want to be. But thanks to the cars, and we have stopped walking. We need to walk a little more, yeah? And of course, you can prevent aging. So aging is another risk factor. Your beta cells become tired after, yeah, as you age. So these are some of the risk factors for the development of type 2 diabetes mellitus. So if you want to think about type 2 diabetes mellitus, in type 1, there was almost no insulin. Yeah, so there is almost undetectable levels of insulin. Whereas type 2 diabetes mellitus is more gray. Yeah, or type 1 is more like all or none, there's no insulin. But here, type 2 diabetes mellitus is kind of different. There is insulin, but the target tissues are not responding appropriately to insulin. And this is known as insulin resistance. This is a very important term. You'll be hearing this over and over again. So the target tissues, that is the liver, the muscle, and the adipose tissue, when they do not respond appropriately to insulin, this is known as insulin resistance. Now, besides that, not only insulin resistance, you will find, if you look at the beta cell insulin secretion, you find that the secretion of insulin by the beta cells is also reduced. So it's actually a two-fold problem. The target tissues are not responding appropriately to insulin, as well as the beta cells of the pancreas are not secreting enough of insulin. So it's a two-fold problem, which basically results in hyperglycemia. Now, most of these patients in the initial stages respond to oral hypoglycemic agents, and insulin may be needed when there is what's called as beta cell fatigue, where the beta cells stop producing or produce very little insulin, and then you may have to supplement these oral hypoglycemic, you may have to supplement insulin. Now, what is very concerning today is the higher incidence of obesity in children. Yeah, even in children, you find the phenomenon of central obesity. And as a result, type 2 diabetes mellitus, like if you think about 20, 30 years ago, not many children had type 2 diabetes mellitus, that is insulin resistance. Whereas with the higher incidence of obesity in children, it is very problematic. Yeah, it's very worrying to the whole world that we are seeing insulin resistance in children. And of course, the risk factor is central obesity and sedentary lifestyle and the video gaming and, of course, all your eyes, yeah, iPad, iPhone, everything. Yeah. So we need to educate our children. We need to educate ourselves in order to be able to develop a much healthier population. Yeah. So it's more like a public health problem now. Yeah. So it's we have to do it like a, you know, like an entire society has to be. We need to wake up the entire society to develop a more healthy lifestyle. Now, if you think about the insulin resistance, so we talked about insulin resistance. So if you think about in a normal person, the amount of insulin that the beta cell secretes every day is about 40 to 50 units of insulin. So if you want to quantify insulin resistance, whenever we need more than 200, yeah, so daily requirement of insulin is about 50 units. So when your requirement or when the production needs to go more than 200 units, that is said to be a state of insulin resistance. That means you need very high levels of insulin to bring about the same biological effect. Yeah. So that is just to quantify what is insulin resistance. Okay. So it's like almost four times the production of insulin. Important anthropometric risk factors is when the most important is, of course, the waist to hip ratio, which is an indicator of abdominal obesity. Greater than 1 in males, in females, greater than 0.8 or 0.9. Yeah? Of course, higher waist circumference when compared to the hip and obesity or BMI more than 30. Now, again, in patients with central obesity, next we'll try to see why is there insulin resistance. There are said to be two reasons. One is number of insulin receptors as such is low, and there is the tyrosine kinase. Something happens to tyrosine kinase and it's no longer responding to that amount of insulin. Yeah, so a lot of study is going on in this direction, and we know a little more than what we knew a few years ago. But remember, we have to study a lot more to understand this completely. Now, these are all the risk factors. Initially, we have a stage of pre-diabetes, which usually extends for a few years. At that time, it's important to identify your patients and make sure they change their lifestyle habits. If not, they are going to progress on to type 2 diabetes mellitus. Now, adipocyte, so when you do the ER system, yeah, endocrine and reproductive system, it's important for you all to understand that adipocyte is not just a storehouse for lipids. Yes, of course, that's its major job. But remember, adipocyte can also function as an endocrine organ. That means it secretes important hormones required for maintenance of the weight balance. What happens when there is central obesity? That is, when your adipocyte increases in size or when there is an increase in the number of adipocytes, is there is increased secretion of leptin. And the body is said to be in a state of leptin resistance, and this is going to contribute to insulin resistance. In other words, the target tissues become less sensitive to insulin. Now, another accompanying finding, endocrine change, is adiponectin, which is secreted from the adipocyte, that is the white adipocyte. Adiponectin secretion is decreased when you increase body weight. So when you become obese, what happens is there is reduced secretion of adiponectin, and this is going to reduce the sensitivity of insulin. In other words, the target tissues become more resistant to insulin. So these are two important factors for the development of insulin resistance: high levels of leptin, less of adiponectin. Besides that, it is said obesity is not a simple problem, because these adipocytes also secrete some cytokines, and we describe obesity as a pro-inflammatory state. That means it's kind of a mild inflammatory state, and this is also contributing to insulin resistance. Okay. Besides that, you know that one of the major modes of management of patients with hypertension is to reduce body weight. Yeah, and that's because obesity also has a role in maintenance of the blood pressure. Okay. So the same thing has been explained here. Also remember that an important lab test used to identify insulin resistance is higher levels of free fatty acids in the circulation. And these free fatty acids are generally coming from the adipose tissue. Yeah. So when there is less of insulin, there is more breakdown of fat in the or triacylglycerol in the adipose tissue. So these free fatty acids in the circulation are said to be toxic to the beta cells and eventually result in beta cell fatigue. Now, besides that, GI hormones, like one of them is GLP or glucagon-like peptide, there is said to be reduced secretion of GLP-1, and remember, this GLP-1 functions like an incretin. It increases the secretion of insulin. So in patients with obesity, it's observed that there is low levels of GLP. And we talked about the cytokines. Okay. So all of these together is contributing to insulin resistance that is seen in type 2 diabetics, yeah, especially with obesity. Now, there are other risk factors that we are not going to talk about much, but this is one of the huge risk factors of importance today. Now, the fasting blood glucose level of greater than 126 is considered as diabetic. When it is between less than 100 is euglycemia or normal blood glucose level. Anything between 100 to 126 is classified as pre-diabetes, which is like a precursor before the happening of diabetes. So if you observe what are the changes in insulin secretion once a patient becomes obese is, one, when you become obese, what happens is there is creation of insulin resistance, and you will find that the secretion of insulin from such a person is much higher than the blue line. So there is much higher levels of insulin secretion from the beta cells. This is the stage of insulin resistance, and at this time you may find normal blood glucose level, but eventually what happens is the patient may go into the pre-diabetes range, that is somewhere between 100 to 126. Once it goes beyond 126, then we say that the person has diabetes mellitus. Okay. So it typically takes years from the development of pre-diabetes to the development of type 2 diabetes mellitus. So what you see on the lower part of the graph here is the development, is the insulin secretion. Note that this is the stage of pre-diabetes where there is insulin resistance, and therefore there is more secretion of insulin. Yeah. Now, note that in the initial stages, the blood glucose level is kind of normal, but as the insulin resistance progresses, and if they do not make changes in the lifestyle, you find that there is an increase in the blood glucose. And this is the stage of pre-diabetes, where the blood glucose level is slightly higher than 100, but it's still lower than the diabetic range. Now, if nothing is done at this point, insulin resistance or insulin secretion, insulin resistance is still there by the tissues, and you will find that insulin secretion decreases with time. And this is what's called as beta cell fatigue. So the beta cells can't respond to the insulin resistance by increasing the secretion of insulin. Okay, and at this stage, you find that the fasting blood glucose level is beyond 126 milligram. Okay. So if you ask the question, what is the insulin level in a type 2 diabetic, it could be anything. It could be high, it could be normal, it could be low. Okay. Whereas in type 1, it is low or undetectable. Okay. Now, type 2 diabetes mellitus is typically hidden in the population. Yeah, and most patients are asymptomatic. And many times the hyperglycemia is present for many years before you actually do the detection and do the tests. Now, some of the common symptoms that I have heard from my friends and you may have heard in the family is frequent changes in prescription glasses, yeah, and that's because of the formation of sorbitol, or repeated infections, sometimes polyuria and polydipsia. Polyuria, especially nighttime, increased frequency of urination at night. So think about type 2 diabetes mellitus. Why is there hyperglycemia in diabetes mellitus? I'd like to use this picture. Please put 3 stars next to this slide because this is it's kind of a confusing slide. Why do you think there is hyperglycemia in a diabetic patient? Now remember, insulin normally inhibits glucose production by the liver. When there is less of insulin or insulin is not effective, what happens is the liver keeps producing glucose. So that is contributing to the hyperglycemia. So the normal function of insulin is to inhibit glucose production by the liver. When there is less of insulin or no insulin, the liver keeps producing glucose. The second defect is the peripheral tissues, adipose tissue and muscle, require insulin for their uptake. That is, the GLUT4 requires insulin. Yeah. So when there is less of insulin or defective action of insulin, adipose tissue and muscle do not take glucose from the blood. So the liver keeps putting out glucose into the blood. That is contributing to hyperglycemia. The peripheral tissues do not take up glucose from the blood. So finally, where is glucose going to be dumped or going to be elevated is in the blood. So both of these are contributing to the hyperglycemia. Remember, this is seen in both type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. Now, besides that, in type 1, there is complete absence of insulin, so insulin is not at all there. Whereas in type 2, there is less secretion of insulin or the target tissues are not responding to insulin. So it's a combination of all these 3 factors that result in hyperglycemia in type 1 or type 2 diabetes mellitus. This is an important slide, so make sure you understand that. Okay? Answer this question. So 2 more seconds and we'll move on. So what did you write? So this is a patient with central obesity. Yeah. So if you look at the anthropometric measurements, you find there is central obesity and there is hyperglycemia. Anything, any value more than 126 is considered hyperglycemia. So patients with central obesity, what do you talk about? The leptin? Remember, leptin secretion is high because adipocytes, the increase in size of the adipocytes will secrete more of leptin. Okay? There's going to be reduced GLP, reduced incretin. Glucose uptake by muscle is decreased and the liver keeps producing glucose, contributing to the hyperglycemia. Okay? So what we have talked till now is all on this slide and we won't go back to this. Okay? So we have talked, why is there hyperglycemia? Decreased immunity is said to... The hyperglycemia is said to affect the T cell function, yeah, the T cell function, and that contributes to higher risk of infections. And that is one of the most frequent complications of type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. Polyuria, we talked about that. Polydipsia is when there is too much loss of fluid, and if there is too much loss of fluid, it can result in dehydration. Okay, weight loss, we explained the cause of the weight loss. Now, type 2 diabetes mellitus, an important cause of death in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus is the occurrence of cardiovascular events. Remember, once a patient is diagnosed with type 2 diabetes mellitus, he is at a high risk of atherosclerosis, and that's because of Remember, type 2 diabetes mellitus is not just identified today, but it has been present for some time, for many years before. Now, because of the insulin resistance syndrome before, or the syndrome X, what happens is you find that they already have an atherogenic profile. That is, if you think about the lipoprotein abnormalities, because of the insulin resistance, they have what's called as atherogenic profile, which is indicated by LDL, the tiny dense ones, which are the most dangerous, and the HDL levels are low, HDL or the protective lipoprotein. Now, besides that, the VLDL level is elevated. Now, for this, you have to go back to lipoprotein metabolism. Lipoprotein lipase, which is required to break down your TAG and VLDL, lipoprotein lipase requires insulin for optimal activity. And patients with insulin resistance will have low activity of lipoprotein lipase, and therefore they have high levels of VLDL in the circulation. Okay, so all of these together, all these three factors together, will increase the risk of cardiovascular events or increase risk of atherosclerosis in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus, said to be the most important cause of death in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus. Now, an important indicator of insulin resistance is high levels of free fatty acids, and that's because the hormone-sensitive lipase that we are going to talk about in the next module, that is not inhibited by insulin in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus. In other words, there is more breakdown of TAG in the adipose tissue because of less insulin or less activity or because of insulin resistance. Important markers for insulin resistance will be increased TAG to HDL ratio and increased serum free fatty acids. Now, lab tests, fasting glucose, anything more than 126 is considered as diagnostic of diabetes mellitus. Random blood glucose, anything more than 200. Yeah? Anytime a patient comes to you and you find a glucose, random blood glucose more than 200, it's considered diagnostic for diabetes mellitus. Of course, you want to confirm by doing the HbA1c. HbA1c was previously used only for the management. Yeah, so it was rarely used in diagnosis, but nowadays it can also be used in the diagnosis of diabetes mellitus. Any level more than 6.5% is diagnostic of diabetes mellitus. Next, we look at the glucose tolerance test. Yeah, what is the glucose tolerance test? Now, the GTT, or the oral glucose tolerance test, is very useful to identify patients before the occurrence of frank diabetes mellitus, that is, in the pre-diabetes range. And we'll try to understand what is the actual use of the glucose tolerance test. I'm not going to talk about HbA1c because we have already seen it, so you can go back and review it. It's just binding of glucose to hemoglobin and is a very good indicator of the control of diabetes or the control of blood glucose level. Remember, higher the HbA1c, more is the risk of complications. Okay. So we'll move on to what is the glucose tolerance test. Now, glucose tolerance test, to do this test, you have to ask the patient to come in the fasting state, take the first sample of glucose, first sample for the estimation of glucose in the fasting state. So that is your first sample, the fasting sample. After that, give them a standard load of glucose. It's usually given orally. Yeah. So you ask them to drink like a glass of glucose water. Typically, you can adjust the dose based on, and adjust the load of glucose based on the body weight, but most of often 75 grams of glucose is adequate. So give them 75 grams of glucose, take blood samples every 30 minutes until 2 hours. So you estimate the fasting blood glucose every 30 minutes and then at the end of 2 hours. Yeah. So the 2 hour is critical and the fasting is critical. The fasting blood glucose should be lower than 100. Yeah, 100 is normal. Anything more than 125 is considered diabetic. So you will find that we have three patients here. Patient 1 has, that is in blue, has a normal fasting. Patient 2 also has a normal, the patient in green. Patient in red is frankly diabetic. Fasting blood glucose is more than 126. Yeah, Now, every half hour, note that there is an increase. So remember, insulin will be secreted, will bring back the blood glucose back to normal. Look at patient 1. The 2-hour blood glucose is below 140. That is considered as normal glucose tolerance. Patient 1 is normal glucose tolerance. 2-hour blood glucose comes back to less than 140. It comes back to less than 140. Look at green patient. The blood glucose at the 2-hour, at 2 hours is more than 140, but less than 200. More than 140, less than 200. This is the region of pre-diabetes. So you have to identify these patients in green, because now is the best time to counsel regarding lifestyle changes, dietary modifications, so that you can postpone the occurrence of frank diabetes mellitus. Okay, so this is patient 2 is a pre-diabetic patient, not yet diabetic, but in at a very high risk of developing diabetes mellitus over the next few years. Patient number 3 has an elevated fasting blood glucose. Already you know that he is diabetic, and you will find that the 2-hour is more than 200. So that most often GTT is not useful for patient 3, most useful for patient 2. And patient 2 is said to have impaired glucose tolerance. Impaired glucose tolerance. Okay. Or a decreased tolerance to glucose. Okay. So impaired. Now, pre-diabetes, there are two important states of pre-diabetes. One is called as the impaired fasting glucose, where the fasting blood glucose is between 100 to 125. So this is like your first red flag. So anytime you find a patient, repeatedly measure the blood glucose. Fasting blood glucose is more than or is in between 100 and 125. We say this is impaired fasting glucose, one of the criteria for prediabetes. The second criteria is, as we saw in the glucose tolerance test, at the two hour, you find levels between 140 to 200. That's also classified as pre-diabetes. Or if you do the HbA1c levels, anything less than 6.5, but more than 5.7, that is also pre-diabetes. It's important that you screen for pre-diabetes, because at this time, so put a star here. If you advise exercise, dietary modifications, improvement of lifestyle, there is a chance to even prevent sometimes or postpone the occurrence. You can postpone it by a few years, yeah, the occurrence of frank diabetes mellitus. So screening usually recommended for people more than 45 years. Yeah, so that is a preventative measure to identify, to increase the identification of pre-diabetics in the population. Okay. So we've talked about all of this, so I'm not going to touch on that. This is the same slide. So basically, what are the tests used for long-term management? Okay. So we'll next move on to what are the different modes of management of diabetes mellitus. Now, the first one is what we are going to concentrate on today. Once you go to pharmacology, you'll be looking at oral hypoglycemia and the role of insulin, the different kinds of insulin and all that. We're just going to briefly touch on these two. I want to impress you all with these three now. Okay. Now, remember that once a patient is identified as a diabetic, it's not like the common cold or something where you're diabetic today and tomorrow there is no diabetes. It's a lifelong treatment plan. Okay, so it requires a lot of education for both the physician as well as the patient. It involves dietary modifications, not very easy, because they need to completely look at every component of their diet. Weight reduction and maintenance of adequate BMI, the optimum BMI, within typically less than 25. Yeah, most of your type 2 diabetics will typically be obese. Exercise and lifestyle modifications. All of these, yeah, especially weight reduction and the lifestyle modifications, will improve the insulin resistance in type 2 diabetes mellitus. And the requirement for insulin will reduce, the requirement for oral hypoglycemic agents will reduce if they are compliant with the weight and the lifestyle modifications. It's very, very, it's very easy to preach, but very difficult to practice. Yeah, because it's like, you know, they need to do a 360 degree change in their entire lifestyle. Try doing it for a few weeks and you'll be like super tired. Yeah, so before you start counseling your patients, I think we have to start doing it ourselves. Yeah, it's not easy. It needs a lot of discipline from the side of the patient as well as from the physician. Yeah, so you need a lot of patience to be able to explain it to them. Okay. Now, we'll talk about dietary modifications. Most of you are aware of it because, you know, diabetes mellitus is so common in the population now that everywhere I go, I see these packets, yeah? So one of the things that is important for regulating or to reduce your blood glucose level is to reduce the refined carbohydrate intake in your diet. And that is basically substituting sucrose or glucose with what's called as artificial sweeteners, yeah? And I'm not going to talk about more about them, but basically you're trying to reduce your intake of refined sugars, okay? So that is one way by which you can reduce your blood glucose level. Now, besides that, encourage the intake of fiber, dietary fiber, because that will reduce the absorption, the rate of absorption of glucose and will lower the glycemic index of the food. And therefore, there is better control of blood glucose level. Now, these patients also have to be taught carbohydrate counting. They have to be taught what is a portion size. And to teach all of this, you need the help of a nutritionist. So you can't do it alone. You need the help of a nutritional team to be able to teach them the carbohydrate or the dietary modifications. Okay. Now, when you think about dietary lipid modification, remember, these patients, especially type 2 diabetes mellitus patients, are at higher risk of cardiovascular disease due to atherosclerosis. So it will be the dietary modifications will be similar to what you would advise for a cardiovascular disease patient. That is low saturated fatty acids, lipid content not more than 30%, and Mediterranean diet has been found to be useful, but encourage the use of fiber, dietary fiber, to lower the serum cholesterol level. Okay, so you can go back and review all of this. We have done this before, so I'm not going to talk too much about it. Besides that, it's kind of reading material. Okay. Now, weight management, the ideal BMI, encourage them to have the weight within the ideal BMI. And again, exercise in weight management becomes super important because you don't want to have a BMI within the optimum range, but have more of adipose tissue. Now, you want to replace your adipose tissue with muscle. So, ideal BMI and loss of central obesity, yeah, optimum waist to hip ratio, yeah, is required for better glycemic control. Now, how does physical activity improve insulin resistance or improve insulin sensitivity? So, basically, you increase your muscle mass. What happens when you do exercise is the muscle will take up glucose even in the absence of insulin. Yeah, so this is an important phenomenon. So exercise. So once you start exercising, your muscle will take up glucose. More number of GLUT4 will be found in the muscle even in the absence of insulin, and that is critical for regulating your blood glucose level or to improving your glycemic control. Besides that, it helps to reduce central or visceral obesity, improves your blood pressure and blood pressure regulation. Okay, so there are a few articles here for those of you who have family members affected with diabetes mellitus. Read it and try to explain it to them. They are your first, you know, kind of your first patient. So try to explain, try to make them understand. Now, pharmacotherapy, we're not going to talk about too much. I'll just try to talk about what is the effect of sulfonylurea. You've already seen sulfonylurea as a cause of hypoglycemia. Yeah, too much taking in sulfonylurea can result in hypoglycemia or low blood glucose level That's because sulfonylurea stimulates the beta cells of the pancreas to release insulin. Okay, so that's how it acts, sulfonylurea. Incretins have been tried, so that's the newer, again, to stimulate the beta cells of the pancreas to release insulin. Metformin and this thiazolidinediones, both of them improve insulin resistance. That is, it acts on the target tissues. Okay. Agents to reduce dietary carbohydrate absorption have also been used. So these are just other methods or which are useful in type 2 diabetics, yeah, not in type 1. In type 1 diabetics and in the later stages of type 2 diabetes mellitus, you may have to use insulin. There are two kinds of insulin treatment depending on patient preference. It can either be intensive, where you have lower HbA1c levels, versus standard. One of the important complications of intensive insulin therapy is the higher risk of hypoglycemia. So patients should be really well motivated. They need to understand the risk of hypoglycemia, the identification of hypoglycemia, and how to prevent the occurrence of hypoglycemia. Yeah, so that's the basic difference between insulin therapy that is intensive versus standard. Okay. Lot of patient education, you know. So your physician assistants will be very useful there. This slide is basically the differences between type 1 and type 2 diabetes mellitus. We have talked about all of it, and you can go back and review it. It's for your, helps you to review for the exam. This is your last question for the day. So let's look at the answer. What did you all write? So that's your answer. So I'd like to wish you all, there is a case study at the end of this. I think you have it in your PDF. So make sure you answer those questions. And I want to wish you all the best for your exam on Monday. Yeah. So wish you all the best, and we'll see you all in the DM module. Thank you.